welcome to the countryside.
Hello, and welcome to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Today, we have a sermon by Pastor Jason Gerlach.
We decided to sign on the dotted line and become first-time homeowners. So far, we haven't regretted purchasing, except for just one day. We'd been in the home for a few months, and on this particular day, we'd been away for most of the morning. At that time, there were four of us, two quite small. After a day of running errands, we were ready to be at home. It may have been a Saturday after we'd completed our whole list of errands. And early on in our marriage, Lee Usherman had taught us to tackle errands by creating a list of all the places that we wanted to go, all the things that we wanted to accomplish, and then rearrange them by store so that they would form one large concentric circle. No backtracking. Anyway, we'd completed our circuit and we were ready for a relaxing time at home. We were ready to throw on sweats, to take a nap, to read. We were ready to do something, although this many years later, I can't quite remember what. As was often the case, Wendy, Jacob, and Nora exited the car before me. I typically dropped them off on the sidewalk and then parked the car, and thus I both exited the car and the garage last. By the time I was walking out of the garage, they were usually already in the house. But on this day, that wasn't the case. I exited the garage to see Wendy holding both children, one under each arm, while unlocking the side door and fixedly staring at the sidewalk between her and me. "There's a snake on the sidewalk," she called. "I'm taking the children inside. Do not come in until you've killed it." So there I stood, 5 feet from a large snake. I weighed my options but quickly realized I had none. I returned to the garage and selected the shovel with the flat end, not the trowel-shaped shovel used to dig holes in the garden or along the fence row. I walked back to the sidewalk, hoping the snake had slithered away. It hadn't. If I have the order correct, I next thought about why this was happening to me. And why had Wendy left me to deal with the snake? I mean, I had no record of killing, nor any fatal encounters with animals. I mean, sure, I'd killed flies. Who hadn't? And once, while driving 35 miles per hour, I bumped a deer in the butt with my front bumper. It had ran right into the street in front of me, and I slammed on my brakes, but I still bumped it. Kind of a glancing blow. No damage to the car, no damage to it. It ran up the bank and seemed to glance at me as if to say, "Good luck, good try, buddy." I was inexperienced. I grew up in the suburban part of Lancaster County. The one time I asked my dad whether we could spend an afternoon rabbit hunting, he put an end to my inquiry right quick by stating, "I've never lost anything in the woods, so why would I go hunting for it?" I didn't find that response to be anything helpful, but whatever. Never had I done anything like this before. I considered the shovel in my hand. Should I swing it hard with the flat part onto the snake's head, or should I use its blade to pin it behind the neck to the sidewalk? I made a decision about which method was best. Next, I tried to build myself up to the action I'd selected. I thought about how the snake was an intruder. We were now the rightful owners of this property. And I thought about our role as parents to protect our children. What if the children were playing in the yard and the snake returned? We had a duty, correct? Wendy had selected an action to remove them from harm. She made an instant wise decision. Now I needed to do my part, I thought to myself. I even repeated it aloud to build up courage. If I'm being honest, I wasn't upset by the snake's presence on our sidewalk early on, but as I inched closer with the shovel in my hand, it slithered toward me. I jumped back, and in that moment, I sensed that my body temperature rose. I was now aware that I was feeling hotter than before, and that I was gritting my teeth and strengthening the grip on the shovel. It slithered again. I seethed. Where was this emotion coming from? Why was I getting angry? Well, I was mad at the position I was in. I didn't feel prepared for it. I didn't feel that it was right that Wendy had imposed this responsibility onto me. So I was mad at Wendy and at the snake. I was mad at the snake because I felt it had a right to be there on our property. I know it was a complicated and messy justification. Retelling it now reminds me how this story serves as a metaphor for today. Anger can stir up unbelievable energy within us. Have you ever gotten so angry that you scared yourself? Have you ever said things and you couldn't believe you were saying them? Have you ever gotten so mad that you broke something? As a kid, I rarely played video games, but I loved sports and I could hold my own for the most part. Tony and I played pickup basketball regularly during the summer, imagining that we were Jordan and Scotty, or Barkley and Mahorn. None of those games flew off the rails. But when the video game NBA Jam was released, Tony purchased it. He had a game console, I did not. Thus, he was much better at the game than me. One weekend, he brought his game console along with the game to my house for a sleepover. Every time we played, he'd swish three-pointers on me, and the commentator, do you remember this, would yell, "He's heating up! He's on fire!" Over and over again, I lost. But I remember sending one game to overtime. The score was close until he hit the last shot. I stormed off and kicked the bathroom door. Why did I do that? What was going on with me? It took a long time for my parents to replace the dented bathroom door. During that time, the dent served as a reminder to me about my own anger. Anger is your body's way of telling you that your will has been blocked. It's an emotion, like any other. It's not the problem. But depending on what you decide next, problems can develop. There is a response to anger that's petty and selfish. It's a whole state of being. It's easily offended. It's an aggression that sits just below the surface and then expresses itself at the strangest times. There's a response to anger that's essentially all about us, our pride, our ego, and how we prop up and defend our selfish little kingdoms. In Jesus' passion narrative, we can identify the wrath of humankind. It builds upon itself until it overtakes the crowd. In Mark's account, we hear the seething crowd demand Pilate to swap Barabbas for Jesus. Their words and actions are recorded. They mocked, spat, taunted, and crucified. Dislike to anger, anger to wrath, all of it lathering up the crowd to take action against Jesus. The wrath of humankind killed Jesus. Wrath blinds people to fuller realities. It takes and takes and takes some more. In 2016, Emerson B. Powery and Rodney S. Sadler Jr. published the book, The Genesis of Liberation, Biblical Interpretations and the Antebellum Narratives of the Enslaved. They were compelled by the question, why did enslaved Africans embrace the religion of their captors, who had used the Bible to justify the brutal transatlantic slave trade? Just a few decades ago, I grew up in suburban Lancaster County, you know, the place without snakes. I grew up in an overly affluent area. I mean, walk into the grocery stores, check the aisles even today, and notice that most of the junk food comes from Lancaster County or areas nearby. Think about it. Turkey Hill ice cream, Utz's chips and pretzels, Hammond's pretzels, Hershey Kisses, Y&S candies, Wilbur chocolate, Snyder's of Hanover, even Hers potato chips. Each long-standing company based out of the same region with an area of disposable income. I didn't grow up in the antebellum South, nor was I alive 150 years ago, but I can recognize some of the injustices that have been propagated throughout my lifetime that continue from long ago. And I'm committed to better understand all human experiences. So I commit not only to read this book once, but a number of times. It's good. I'd recommend it. My precursory read led to new understandings about how formerly enslaved persons interpreted the Bible as an important document and a means of survival rather than an oppressive and pro-slavery text. Powery and Sadler's research on original sources produced the following observations. One, some freedom narratives included biblical quotations on the title page. Often the selected verse was appropriated to include an appeal to God or human agents as active participants for change. Two, some freedom narratives included a clear breadth of many of the biblical books, exemplified by regular allusions to the biblical story. Three, most freedom narratives reflected on the use of the Bible as the talking back book. Let's take a moment to define the talking back book trope. Masters were known to extrapolate about obedience, usually quoting from Colossians 3, Ephesians 6, or 1 Peter 2, stating that the Bible says, and then they'd go on. Thus, it quickly became affixed that the Bible spoke to masters, often only to them. James Albert Gravenasol's freedom narrative includes this example. Hear his words. My master used to read prayers in public every Sabbath day, and when first I saw him read, I was never so surprised in my whole life as when I saw the book talk to my master, for I thought it did, as I observed him to look upon it, and his lips moved. I wished it would do so with me. As soon as my master had done reading, I followed him to the place where he put the book, being mightily delighted with it. And when nobody saw me, I opened it, put my ear down close upon it, in great hopes that it would say something to me. But I was very sorry and greatly disappointed when I found that it would not speak. Taken together, the freedom narratives name the emergence of a liminal space, a time between what was and next, a place of transition, waiting, and not knowing. It could have followed that out of the liminal space came anger, and from anger, wrath. And for some people, it did. Others flipped the experience upon itself and worked to reclaim the biblical text. As Powery and Sadler name, these formerly enslaved individuals lifted up the pen to write and raised the voice to speak about an experience of enslavement that included a religious setting in which the Bible was frequently interpreted to enforce and maintain their status and condition. For the most part, they sifted through these theological constructions to reclaim the Bible for themselves and placed it on the side of the oppressed. In light of the conditions of the day, this took an unimaginable ingenuity. They took a text used against them and made it their own, often reversing the implications of normative mainline interpretive patterns. Powery and Sadler's most frequent assertion is that almost all freedom narratives include reference to the biblical Exodus story, which functioned as an archetypal event. The narratives appropriated the Exodus story to articulate their sense of historical identity as people. Consider it now with me. The setting is Midian, the wilderness. Moses is working, tending the flock of his father-in-law near Mount Horeb, when he notices something, well, unusual. There is a bush, and it's on fire. But the fire doesn't appear to be doing anything to the bush. It just sort of hovers there. And Moses, predictably enough, feels the need to get a better look. As he approaches the bush, the flame begins to speak. More, the flame doesn't just ask Moses how he's doing. It identifies itself as the God of Moses' ancestors, the God of whom the Hebrews had recently begun to call out, asking for deliverance from their oppressors. It is at this point that we get the critical element of the drama, the conflict of sorts, between God and Moses. God needs Moses to be God's prophet, to go back to Egypt, and to confront the Pharaoh and tell him that God wants him to free the Hebrew people. But Moses doesn't want that job. Why should he give up everything to return to the country where he is already persona non grata, to lead a slave rebellion against the most powerful government in the world? To which God replies, quite simply, "I will be with you." "But who are you anyway?" Moses asks. "I mean, what is your name? If I go to the Hebrews and tell them that the God of their ancestors has sent me to lead them out of Egypt, don't you think they're going to want a name?" This is where things get really interesting. In the historical context of this text, "what is your name?" is no inconsequential question. The peoples of the ancient Near East, most of whom worshiped the various tribal gods of their ancestors, believed that knowing and using the names of those gods lent the user a share of the god's power. Thus, to know a god's name was to have a measure of protection from the god's frequent and sometimes violent capriciousness, and to possess the capacity to use that capriciousness against one's enemies, who presumably would be the enemy of one's god as well. Moses wants to know, who is this god? And if Moses is going to go up against a formidable enemy, an arsenal sufficient to complete the job is necessary. God's response, providing God's name, "I am." God's admonition to Moses could be read simultaneously as a refusal by God to play Moses' game and as an assurance that the identity of the God speaking from the bush renders the question irrelevant. God is telling Moses that this God is an altogether different kind of deity than the Egyptian god of Moses' childhood or the household gods of the surrounding tribes. The God who speaks to Moses from the bush can in no way or for any cause be used, but it also is a God who is without caprice and therefore absolutely trustworthy. God, whose character is steadfastly and unconditionally to love the created world, has freely promise that "I am" will remain their God and ultimately will secure their redemption because God loves them and keeps promises. With that in mind, think about part of Jesus' crucifixion. The wrath of humankind isn't the story's end, for Jesus arose. Jesus overcame death, conquering it with love. But here's the thing. When you'd expect fanfare, there isn't any. In the gospel accounts, the first and predominant emotions in the earliest Easter moments are not triumph, joy, or jubilation, but rather grief, fear, and bewilderment. Women head to the tomb to care for Jesus' murdered body. In John's gospel, Mary Magdalene alerts the disciples about the missing body with enough urgency that they take off running toward the tomb. Nobody is quite sure what's going on. The gospel accounts of that first Easter are raw. They get the information out, but they certainly leave a lot of questions unanswered. Death, in and of itself, disorients the living. Adding life after death into the mix is totally foreign, completely overwhelming, almost unrecognizable. During our Holy Week services, and in this Sunday's theme of wrath and love, we, the church, don't spend enough time in the bewildering liminal space. Instead, we skip ahead in the story to celebrate. But by doing so, we aren't fully present to these texts. And that leads to a missed opportunity to create space for people whose grief or pain is their most present reality. People who need to weep, just like Mary Magdalene. People whose bodies carry the marks of the tomb, dark experiences and uneasy feelings. People who find it near impossible to imagine what life looks like on the other side of heavy, deep, and real. Jesus overcame death, conquering it with love, but that wasn't realized, at least for Mary Magdalene, until Jesus addressed her by name. That act of love extended to Mary signified that she was known, and only then did she recognize Jesus. Jesus overcame death, conquering it with love. And similarly to Mary Magdalene's experience, Jesus calls each of us by name, not overlooking any person, inviting you and them, inviting she, Z, me, and he to respond to God's love anew. These past 8 weeks, our worship service has focused on vices and virtues. We've also referred to it by its subtitle, Snakes and Ladders. I'm sorry, but I couldn't let us go 8 weeks without including a snake story. As this is the concluding Sunday, I feel it's important to note that each of the seven deadly sins is a perversion of love. Too much self-interest becomes pride. Too much compassion to others becomes envy. Too much comparison to others becomes envy. Too much fixation on money or food. You get the picture. And in regards to wrath, when we speak about God's wrath, it must be understood in relation to God's love. Wrath is not a permanent attribute of God. For whereas love and holiness are part of God's essential nature, wrath is contingent upon human sin. If there were no sin, there would be no wrath. The God who rules the world from burning bush and the manger and the insurrectionist's cross shows up when we gather, giving God's very self to each of us, nourishing us, renewing our minds and orienting them to love, if we but respond when God calls us by name.
Thank you for listening to the Community Mennonite Church podcast. Our theme music is a setting of John Wesley's text, Jesus, I Believe You're Near, composed by Matt Carlson. Jeremy Nafziger arranged it for strings. To learn more about our congregation or to plan a visit, please check out our website at cmcva.org.